What J. Pal giveth, J. Pal can taketh away, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 30th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So look, to be clear, it's not like Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve have all the power in this economy right now. But they've got a lot. So when the Fed chair speaks, attention must be paid. Powell gave a speech today at the Brookings Institution in Washington, took some questions afterward. And the two things that struck us were a little newsy, sure, but also kind of, wait, what? Here is tidbit number one.
The time for moderating the pace of rate increases may come as soon as the December meeting.
I'll translate here if you need it. That is Powell saying, without actually using the words, that all other things being equal, the next interest rate increase, which comes in about 2 weeks, is going to be a half a percentage point, not three quarters, as they have been. But he then said this, too.
It will take substantially more evidence to give comfort that inflation is actually declining. And by any standard, inflation remains far too high.
So while it might kind of sort of look like inflation might have peaked, Powell is saying here the Fed is not having it. Inflation's still real and rates are going to stay high. So that's the Fed with some mixed signals. But the central bank's got plenty of company in the mixed signals department in this economy right now. Thank you very much. We got an update on third quarter gross domestic product this morning, revised up to 2.9% growth July through September. That is annualized, of course. And one key reason for that is strong consumer spending, up 0.6% in September, expected to be up even more when we get October's reading tomorrow. On the other hand, the Conference Board reported yesterday that its main consumer confidence index was down again for the second straight month. And the University of Michigan reported the other day that its consumer sentiment gauges have fallen back toward the all-time low that they hit this summer. So, we're spending, but we feel lousy about it? Again, I say, wait, what? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Consumers say they're bummed that things in the economy are going crummy. Lynn Franco at the Conference Board describes the overall attitude as
cautious, pessimistic about the future in terms of expectations. That's been generally what we see during a recession or prior to a recession.
And yet, even after accounting for inflation, we're still going out and buying more stuff every month. But inflation is changing our behavior, says Joanne Hsu, director of consumer surveys at the University of Michigan.
Even though the aggregate numbers show really strong consumer spending, two-thirds of consumers tell us they have cut back on things with the largest price increases. So they're substituting away to cheaper goods.
Also, as inflation and higher interest rates bite, there's been a shift in who can afford to keep spending it up, says Kayla Brune at Morning Consult.
It's a very different story when you look at different income groups.
Brune says it's largely the $100,000 plus set that's fueling higher spending on big ticket consumer items and travel.
Higher income groups did manage to accumulate more savings during the pandemic, have higher incomes to begin with, so are less affected by inflation.
By contrast, for households earning $50,000 or less,
that group, we actually see declining spending in real terms, you know, after accounting for inflation and a lot more price sensitivity, more walking away from purchases they don't feel they can afford.
One thing above all is keeping consumers' wallets open at every income level. And that's the strong job market, says the University of Michigan's Joanne Hsu.
Even though they feel like this inflation situation is dire, they're largely expecting a recession. They are telling us their income expectations are strong. They don't expect to lose their jobs.
If consumers see clear signs of that changing, Hsu says expect them to tighten their wallets pretty darn quick. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders heard that Jay Powell speech about the pace of rate increases, you know, maybe slowing down. And they took that all the way to the bank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. news out of China comes in two varieties today. The spot news, you might say, of the death overnight of former President Jiang Zemin, who led China through a period of explosive economic growth back in the 1990s. And then what is turning into a trend story of sorts, the protests across that country, originally over COVID restrictions. But now, as Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports, there is a lot more going on than just that.
If you didn't know, walking around this section, you'd think it's just normal weekend traffic. That's not the case today. Just about a block over from where I am right now, young people have been staging protests.
Protesters sing the Chinese national anthem. One line says, "Stand up, stand up, stand up." These protests were set off after a deadly apartment fire far west in Urumqi City, Xinjiang. People suspect COVID restrictions are to blame. Young people tried to lay flowers for the 10 fire victims. I spot two men with bundles of chrysanthemums.
Sorry, I'm just with the American Public Media. I'm with Marketplace. Can I ask you a few questions?
No?
Okay.
Actually, you know, this is a little bit sensitive right now.
So sensitive and worried about official retaliation that even those who did speak to me would not give their names, like this American businessman.
I don't think anyone can tolerate this anymore. People in Xinjiang got locked down for like more than 3 months. In Shanghai, 2.5 months. It was difficult. It was so difficult. So many people got depression.
Protests have extended to other cities, like Chengdu in southwest China, which has been in and out of lockdown. A widely circulated video showed dozens of people facing off against a line of police officers. Do you know how many shops are sitting empty? One resident asked the police. You, she says, meaning the cops, aren't worried because you still get paid. That's our taxes, our savings, feeding you. You know that? Back in Shanghai, protesters chant, no more PCR COVID tests. We want freedom. China's zero COVID policy has shown how much control the government has over residents. Communist neighborhood committees and even security guards are now our gatekeepers for the most basic decisions. Can I get food today? Can I travel or visit a hospital? Some protesters even called for the Communist Party and its top leader, Xi Jinping, to step down, a dangerous thing to do. Others opted to protest by holding up blank pieces of paper, a tactic they hoped would not lead to arrest. There was a second day of protests on Shanghai's Urumqi Road, but by the time I arrived, the authorities had blocked off the protest site. No entry, says this cop. Exit only. A delivery driver says he's not allowed in either. He has no idea why. Many people in China still haven't heard about the protests because of heavy censorship. A young man, unhappy with this information lockdown, marched up to the cops at a barricade. What are you controlling? He asks. Traffic, the cop says. Why? We've told you everything we know, says one officer. We're just here to execute orders. I could give you a number to complain. You want me to complain about you to your people? What am I, crazy? The young man says. Then bystanders hold him away. But a number of people, including foreign journalists, were detained. It wasn't all tense. A bakery stuck within the police barricade came out with bread to feed the curious bystanders. Bread and toast, all 15% off, the staff says. But I don't stick around. I'm off to get a PCR test. Just as the police were dispersing protesters, the Shanghai government announced a tightening of rules. If we want to dine out, go to the mall, or get a massage, we'll need a PCR test every 48 hours instead of the usual 72. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Founder and former CEO of the now kaput cryptocurrency exchange FTX told Axios this week that he's got $100,000 left in his bank account. Best guesses as to Sam Bankman-Fried's personal fortune before that? $26.5 billion. It is tough to feel sorry for him, of course. Plenty of FTX users would love to have $100,000 in their accounts right about now. But I mention that because the fallout from the FTX implosion continues to spill into the broader economy, including across college campuses, where the next generation of tech and finance talent is deciding whether crypto is an industry they really want to be in. Marketplace's Matt Levin has that one.
Crypto companies salivate over students like Akshay Chowdhury. He's a senior at Columbia, majoring in applied mathematics and minoring in computer science. So if a crypto exchange tried to hire him with a boatload of money?
I, quite frankly, probably would have been more amenable to that before the past 3 or 4 weeks.
Of course, crypto companies aren't really in hiring mode right now. Even solvent exchanges like Coinbase have been laying off workers. But even if they were, Chowdhury says the overnight implosion of FTX made the industry seem way too volatile.
From the perspective of putting your career eggs in that basket, I don't think that's something that I would want to do.
During crypto boom times, the best and the brightest at elite universities are, shocker, more interested in crypto. Crypto classes at engineering and business schools are now pretty common. John Villasenor has noticed a particular correlation among his UCLA computer science students.
I've found in the last 7, 8 years that interest in the crypto space, generally speaking, tends to track the price of Bitcoin.
This brutally cold crypto winter will likely cool that interest, but Villasenor says it won't deter a particular type of student, those more interested in the underlying technology.
There's always been a subset, a smaller subset of people who are very interested in blockchain. Blockchain is a lot more than crypto.
Campbell Harvey at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business is expecting smaller attendance at the Innovation in Crypto Ventures class he's teaching this spring. But as a decentralized finance enthusiast, Harvey says the FTX debacle could actually make his MBA students even more marketable.
They're much more professional in terms of business practices. And in this space, it really lacks people with traditional business experience.
You know, traditional business experiences like creating a decent balance sheet, or at least a balance sheet that won't go viral on Twitter. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we just hired somebody to do essentially just gift wrap.
Hey, look, it's a tight labor market, right? First, though, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Yay, here you go. Dow Industrials gained 737 points today, about 2.2%, 34,589. The NASDAQ added 484 points, 4.4%, 11,468. The S&P 500 up 122 points, almost 3.1% there, finished at 4,080. The cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, though, tumbled 14.75% as it issued a worse-than-expected revenue outlook for the present quarter. CEO George Kurtz cited increased economic headwinds that caused some customers to delay purchases. I would just suggest delaying cybersecurity software purchases right now. Probably not a great idea. I don't know. Bond prices up. Yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.61%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just in the keeping track of what's going on category right now, there have been a bunch of layoffs announced this week. AMC Networks is cutting 20% of its workforce. CNN's previously rumored layoffs are starting, and DoorDash says it's cutting about 1,200 corporate jobs. The food delivery app is the latest tech firm looking to control cost as the market mantra changes from growth to actual profits. DoorDash and all those other delivery apps saw plenty of growth during the pandemic, but profits obviously have been far more elusive. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports on where delivery apps might be heading in this changing economy.
Alex Suskind is a restaurant guy, personally and professionally. He teaches food and beverage management at Cornell.
I was a complete non-delivery, non-third-party delivery person under any circumstances.
Until 2020.
And now we're using those services more than I would have imagined.
At the onset of the pandemic, these apps exploded, and DoorDash and Uber have come to dominate the market in the U.S. But just as workout apps, streaming services, and video conferencing businesses are finding out, that kind of momentum is hard to keep up.
That trend of eating at home or off-premise somewhere, I don't believe that that is going to go away. It's how do they get that food?
Molly Harnischfeger is a food industry consultant with Alex Partners. She says consumers have changed their habits, but especially as inflation has worsened, the high fees these apps charge for delivery have become a bigger barrier for consumers and for restaurants.
It was a lifeline during the pandemic, but going forward, you know, it's not necessarily sustainable to give a cut of the profit to these companies.
She says restaurants are increasingly building their own online ordering systems or using lower cost plugins from third parties geared more toward takeout. But even if third party delivery apps have seen the appetite for the service level off, they've still got a smorgasbord of user data, says Vijay Gurbaksani, a business professor at UC Irvine.
There's a lot of insights, and this data is ripe for exploitation.
The apps might be able to help restaurants predict changing patterns of customer taste or the habits of regulars. For instance, that Gurbaksani is likely to order delivery when returning home from an exhausting Thanksgiving week vacation.
Cactus tacos, I'll have you know.
Even if they do cost almost twice the price of takeout. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
A number from the Federal Trade Commission to set up this next piece. Almost 3 million Americans said they were the victims of fraud last year, with losses that came to more than $5.5 billion. The FTC also says more scams are happening on social media than ever before. Of course, online fraud happens across borders, which means it's kind of a gray area without a single authority that's actually got jurisdiction. So into that void has stepped a group of people known as scam baiters, people who conceal their identities and pretend to fall for scams so that they can get information and then shut those scammers down. From our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, Marketplace's Peter Bellinon Rosen brings us the story of one woman and her mission to fight scammers head on.
The other week, I had this video call with someone so protective about her identity that it was cameras off, only talk from an encrypted device, no real names.
Hey, I'm playing with criminals all day long. You will be careful as well in my place, right?
Well, I have you logged in here as Carrie. I guess I'll just call you Carrie.
Sure.
Okay, cool. So yeah, Carrie. Fake name, because she's this underground online crime fighter. She says it started over a decade ago when she fell victim to a romance scam. She'd met John online. He was American military serving in Iraq, a single dad with a teenage son.
I tried to have children before and it wasn't working for me, so I imagine that I can maybe have a life where my life partner has a son of his own.
It felt like a dream come true. For weeks, they emailed Carrie in Central Europe, John in Iraq. But then John and his son kept asking Carrie for money. She'd sent them 1,700 euros, more than half her savings, when she read this article about scam victims.
Talking about military guys they met online and the money they lost because of those guys. And yeah.
Carrie confronted John, confirmed it was a scam, and decided she wanted to stop this from happening to others.
I decided to become a scam baiter.
To join a community of people online who hide their identities and bait scammers by pretending to fall for scams. The goal? Mess with scammers, publish information about their tactics, and report them to local authorities. Carrie made a profile on a free dating site, a place of bad security known for scammers, and there she transformed into this guy.
My first persona was 56 years old, divorced, bald, drinking a lot of beer, and searching for his other half.
Before long, Carrie was getting 5 or 6 scam messages every day.
I never winked, I never smiled at them, nothing. I just sit there waiting for them to contact me.
Carrie would come home from her 9-to-5 office job and message scammers to learn about the emails, the bank accounts, the pictures, the phone numbers used by scammers. She'd post it all on a website to make scammers' lives harder and to reach potential victims. Carrie and other baiters would also alert banks to transfers and accounts used in scams. Keeping scammers interested without sending money turned into this game.
You always are ready to send the money. but every time something happens and you cannot.
Carrie learned behind individual scammers, there's often a whole operation where there's someone who ropes a victim in, someone who flirts, someone who requests money, plus a boss.
He's not directly involved. He's just distributing the work and getting the biggest part of the cash.
Wait, so if I'm just picturing this, it almost kind of sounds like a corporate environment, right?
Yes.
Where you have like the entry-level people, you have their managers, and then you have like the CEO at the top?
Yes.
Carrie and other scambaiters scrub the internet of any traces of their real life to become their online personas. She says right now, ahead of the holidays, scammers are working extra hard to sell fake goods and to target lonely people with romance scams. Carrie's tracking and exposing who she can. Why keep up with this? It kind of feels like you're fighting an uphill battle that you're never going to win, if I'm honest.
Yeah, agree with you. But hey, at least you can try to keep the place clean.
Carrie had her own victory recently. She started seeing a cute guy in real life. And how does he feel about you being a scam baiter?
Well, he doesn't know the details of what I'm doing online.
He doesn't know?
No.
They've been dating for a few months now. She says maybe one day she'll let him in on her secret identity. I'm Peter Balanon-Rosen for Marketplace.
We talked consumers at the top of the show, so now we come almost full circle to one of the people consumers might be buying stuff from. Irene Kesselman's one of our retail regulars. She runs Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina, and she sent us this dispatch about how things are going at this point in her all-important holiday shopping season.
Right now, our business has slowed down a bit during the month of November. Prices have gone up and are continuing to go up across the board. It puts a lot on us in terms of what we do is we really look at each order, each item that perhaps has had an increase, and we determine if in fact we are going to raise it or we may not choose to raise it at all so that we can compete with other people, with other stores, I should say. I will definitely be more selective as I buy for the new season, which I'm already doing. Our staffing is, you know, up and running for the holidays. We could probably stand to use another body, and we may, in fact, hire somebody just last minute. We just hired somebody to do essentially just gift wrap because that's what we need, somebody to do that and curl ribbon. Every year we offer an adult shopping night, which is the first Thursday of every December. And that's really when we officially kick off our holiday shopping season. So, we just hope that in the next 4 weeks, people continue to come out and enjoy their shopping experience with us.
Irene Kesselman, Alley Cat Toys, Carrboro, North Carolina. This final note on the way out today, Jay Powell is not just the Fed chair, you know. He's a book publisher, too. Well, kind of. I mean, the Fed is. The Federal Reserve's Beige Book came out today. The central bank's region by region, and this is important, it is anecdotal, their look at this economy. So here's just a couple of highlights from today's. From the St. Louis Fed, and these are all actual quotes, by the way, a contact in the catfish industry reported pushback on higher prices, which led to that business decreasing prices. Take that, Jay Powell. Also, restaurants in Little Rock. Take that, Jay Powell. That was me. Also, restaurants in Little Rock have reported that their customer volumes are up 50% from last year, 50%. And this from the Minneapolis Fed. A staffing contact said that holiday hiring has pushed seasonal wages notably higher. Think about what Irene Kesselman just said. With entry-level shelf stocking positions reaching $25 an hour. All right, super quick, a moment of economic context for you on our way out. A quick check on oil, kind of seems like it's been a while. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate up almost 3% today, just a hair over $80 a barrel. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.